Good evening. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington, and this is Crossroads Asia. Tonight on our program, a tragic boat accident in South Korea. A new report shows China's economy keeps growing, but at a slightly slower pace than before. We'll have these stories and more coming your way in the next half hour here on VOA's Crossroads Asia. There were a number of people dead and missing Wednesday following the sinking of a ferry boat off South Korea's southern coast. Authorities initially reported most of the passengers rescued, but quickly backtracked and raised casualty figures dramatically as the scale of the tragedy became clear. Daniel Scharf reports from Seoul.
South Korean authorities say the passenger ferry was carrying 459 people when it sent out a distress signal at 9 o'clock in the morning. Reports quoted passengers saying they heard a loud noise before the 6,000-ton vessel began to tilt and then capsize and sink. It was almost completely submerged in just hours. Scores of Coast Guard, military, and private vessels responded to the disaster to rescue survivors. They were joined by helicopters and Navy divers to search the area and sunken wreckage. Most of those on board were high school students headed from Incheon to the southern resort island Jeju on a four-day school trip. South Korean authorities initially reported 368 passengers were rescued, including all of the students. But just minutes later, authorities dropped the estimate dramatically. Kang Byung-kyu is a minister of security and public administration. He says as part of search and rescue efforts, they will send three cranes to lift the sunken ship in the next 2 days. He says of the number of people who have been found so far, 78 on the list of rescued are students. The students all were from Ansan, a town just south of Seoul. Compounding the tragedy, the Municipal Office of Education sent out a text message to parents saying all of their children were safe. School authorities say they quickly organized buses for parents to be taken to the scene. The ship, the Sewol, sank at a depth of 30 meters, leading to speculation it may have come aground or hit a rock. South Korean media reports say the ferry's regular captain was on vacation and another captain was at the helm. Lee Jong-in is a representative of Salvage Company Alpha and an expert on maritime safety and rescue. He says the ferry company will investigate the sinking, but the captain could have been careless. He says ultimately the captain of the ship is the one responsible for it. Lee says such incidents are rare in South Korea. The last major sinking was the Navy vessel Chonan in 2010, which Seoul says was hit by a North Korean torpedo, killing 46 sailors. Pyongyang denies it was responsible. South Korea's President Park Geun-hye on Wednesday visited the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures headquarters. She urged them to do their best to rescue the missing. Daniel Scharf, VOA News, Seoul.
The robotic submarine searching for the wreckage from a missing Malaysian airliner was forced to cut short its mission today. The Australian agency coordinating the search said an unspecified technical problem forced the Bluefin 21 autonomous underwater vehicle to resurface. It said the vehicle was subsequently redeployed to continue the search, adding that an initial analysis of data retrieved has revealed no significant detections. The agency gave no explanation for what caused the interruption or how long it lasts. China's economy expanded 7.4% in the first quarter, January through March, down from the previous quarter's 7.7% growth rate, and the slowest quarterly pace in 18 months. National Bureau of Statistics spokesman Chun Lei-yun described the performance as staying within a reasonable range. Chun cautioned the world's second largest economy, China, faces headwinds from what he calls downward pressures from the external environment. China's target growth rate so far for 2014 is 7.5%. The government also says industrial output gained 8.8% last month, while retail sales, a key barometer of consumer sentiment, and government spending on infrastructure were also higher. Scott Kennedy, director of Indiana University's Research Center of Chinese Politics and Business, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the slowdown is caused by a recent limit on credit expansion, something that has fueled much of China's growth in the past.
Even though the overall credit numbers are still growing, they're not growing as fast as they used to be. And so you see a slowdown in overall manufacturing and investment. And I think that helps explain the slowdown. I don't think we ought to be overly concerned about it. We knew growth is going to come in slower. What's important is the quality of growth.
They've promised no big stimulus like they had following the global financial downturn of several years ago.
Yeah. I mean, you still have a very good foundation for rapid growth for a long time because of the transition from agriculture to industry and now the transition from industry to services and a growing number of people getting better educated, transportation and logistics to Western China expanding, a variety of reforms they're undertaking. So there's plenty of good reasons to think that this economy's high growth period hasn't come to an end yet.
Julian Evans Pritchard, China economist at the Singapore-based Capital Economics, says the growth figure might have been worse except for a pickup in investment spending and industrial output in March. He forecasts slower growth in the next quarter. Evans Pritchard says policymakers in China appear comfortable with the current pace of growth. Last week, Chinese Premier Li Keqiang ruled out a big stimulus program like the one put in place following the 2008 global financial downturn.
We think that basically he's going off what he did last year, which proved quite successful. Policymakers are concerned about credit growth. So I think what they don't want to do is they don't want to unleash a whole new credit binge, which is just going to increase credit risk down the line. So what they're looking to do is what they did in the second half of last year, where they keep liquidity conditions relatively tight, allow credit growth to continue to slow, but at the same time sort of use targeted measures such as the fiscal spending that's been announced to make sure growth doesn't fall below their comfort range. But what I think is interesting about Li Keqiang's comments is that he presumably already knew what today's GDP figures were going to be. So I think that shows that they're comfortable with the pace of growth at the moment. And I think that makes sense because their main concern is the labor market, but today's data show that wage growth continues to outpace output growth. So a growing share of income is going to households. So the labor market still looks healthy. So I don't think it's a huge concern. And I think policymakers will try to avoid stepping in with monetary stimulus if they can avoid it.
What is your forecast for the rest of the year? And are you concerned about a possible hard landing?
Our forecast for the rest of the year is 7.3%. So we do think growth will continue to slow, and that's just a natural byproduct of slowing credit growth. But we're not concerned about a hard landing. Policymakers have all the tools in their hand to step in, support growth if they want to. So what they're trying to achieve is a balancing act between slowing credit growth and achieving reasonable growth.
Gary Huffbauer of the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says one of China's biggest engines of growth has been real estate investment, but such investment has been slowing recently.
That's really the only thing that people feel they can put their money in where it's relatively safe. But maybe they've overdone it, and the vacancies of apartments in many of the cities, which are a million people and more, are very large people, but a lot of the professionals, they bought second apartments and, you know, even third apartments, and that's where they put their money, and the building is way above what the demand is. So it looks like that segment of investment is going to go down a lot. The whole economy, about 40%, 35, 40% is investment, but of that, a good 10 to 15% is this real estate investment, and that looks like being pretty weak now. So that's the concern.
So your forecast is for even slower growth?
Yes, even slower growth going forward this year. I'm hoping, though, that they can keep it to, you know, keep the growth rate to 6%. But this ripples right across Asia, so it, and indeed across the world. So that's a concern.
China has been trying to guide its economy toward more domestic consumption and away from a heavy reliance on trade and investment. Asian stock markets rose today, a sign investors are relieved that the slowdown was not as severe as some analysts had forecast. China today also rejected an Obama administration report that says its currency, the yuan, remains too weak. A foreign ministry spokeswoman said China would continue to perfect and regulate its currency exchange rate mechanism. She called on the U.S. to take a cooperative and constructive attitude toward China's reform efforts. A U.S. Treasury report to Congress on Tuesday stopped short of accusing China of manipulating its currency raised, but expressed serious concerns that China has retreated from its intention to allow the currency exchange rate to reflect the market. Nicholas Borst, Peterson Institute China Program Research Associate, says the U.S. is trying to keep the issue outside the political spotlight.
Even when the level of intervention by the Chinese Central Bank was more severe than what we're seeing right now, both the Bush and Obama administrations have held back from declaring China a currency manipulator. And I think the reason for that is both administrations have been worried that if they attach this language of manipulation, then people in the Congress will get hold of it and suddenly they'll lose control of the issue in a way that's counterproductive to getting what they really want. But the Chinese do have some things to answer for. So this recent round of renminbi depreciation, which, you know, offsetted a couple years of gradual appreciation that we've seen, the line from the central bank was that this was a market-driven round of appreciation and that basically they had nothing to do with it. We've now received the reserve data for the first quarter, and we can see that, in fact, it wasn't a market-driven depreciation event. The people think China continued to intervene heavily throughout the first quarter, acquired more than $100 billion in new reserves. And so I do think it calls into question some of the new rhetoric from the central bank about letting the market play a greater role. From what we've seen in the last quarter, I'd say they haven't adopted that wholeheartedly yet.
Do you see this still as a politically viable issue?
The one thing to keep in mind here is that we haven't seen a return in the huge trade surpluses that we saw during the mid-2000s. And so on the one hand, you can say, yes, China is back in the manipulation game again. It's clearly intervening with the currency. It's not letting market forces take hold. But at the same time, the main cause of concern, the large external surpluses, you know, China peaked at 10% of GDP current account surplus in 2007. Now we're down to 2% as of last year. So I think the argument that this level of intervention is causing direct harm to U.S. economic prospects is less strong than it was back then.
Some U.S. lawmakers have accused China of undervaluing its currency to gain an edge in international trade. The Treasury report says China has amassed nearly $4 trillion in foreign currency reserves, calling that excessive. The report also criticized South Korea for heavily intervening on behalf of its currency, the yuan, to slow its rate of appreciation. This is Crossroads Asia on the Voice of America. I'm Dave DeForest in Washington.
In-depth reporting and analysis. That's what you'll get throughout the day when you listen to VOA's International Edition. From every corner of the earth, wherever the news is being made, the Voice of America is gathering reports, talking to the newsmakers and analysts, and preparing the kind of in-depth newscast you deserve. From politics to disasters, from economics to science and technology, we have the range to cover the news that interests you. Check us out for yourself. Listen to International Edition, Monday through Friday, during VOA's broadcasts in your region of the world.
In recent weeks, news surfaced in China about the fate of some of the so-called heroes of Chongqing's anti-mafia campaign. One of the most controversial marks left by purged politician Bo Zhilai in the city he governed. The campaign led to thousands of arrests and several high-profile executions, but also drew allegations of police and court abuses, which authorities have been slow to redress. Rebecca Valley has this report.
In its heyday, Bo Xilai's campaign against organized crime helped him build his reputation as a rising star in the Communist Party. But months after Bo's high-profile downfall on corruption charges, Chinese media reports have detailed the fate of the policemen who helped him during his fight against Chongqing's local mafia. One of them committed suicide, apparently because of health problems. Four are detained or serving jail sentences. Others are still working in Chongqing's police forces and have since been promoted. During Bo's trial, prosecutors steered away from the anti-mafia campaign in Chongqing. They did not mention Bo's role in ordering or allowing police abuses, which became more public following his downfall. Even now, there is little information about the extent of the crackdown. Lawyer Li Zhuang was jailed in 2010 on charges that he forced his client, a Chongqing crime boss, into forging testimony. He says there's no public information about the amount of assets confiscated, the amount given back, how many people have been arrested and sentenced, how many people have been executed or sent to labor camps, how many people have been beaten to death or injured by police. All these figures, he says, are still a secret and they have yet to be disclosed. The Strike the Black campaign started as an effort to get rid of gangsters' alliances and the umbrella of political protection they used to gain power in Chongqing. During the peak of Chongqing's anti-mafia campaign, Chongqing's methods to fight the mob were made into a nationwide model. By purging Bo Xilai, analysts believe the central government has sent an indirect signal against such large-scale campaigns. He Weifang is a prominent legal scholar at Beijing University. He says that it would be very rare now for such outrageous anti-mafia campaigns, the way Chongqing did it, to happen in other places in China. But he adds that the most positive effect will come when authorities will establish the mistakes they made during the crackdown and re-examine wrongful convictions. For VOA News, this is Rebecca Valli in Hong Kong.
With over 200 million internet users in India, social media has become a new campaign tool for a country where politicians have long relied on mass rallies and door-to-door campaigns. Anjana Pasricha reports on how the new technology is faring compared to traditional methods of wooing voters.
Nearly a year and a half ago, Akhilesh Mishra took a sabbatical from his job as a marketing professional in New Delhi to play a lead role in the opposition Bharatiya Janata Party's social media campaign. Mishra says he, along with other volunteers, set out to use platforms such as Twitter and Facebook to convey what they believed was the real picture of BJP leader Narendra Modi. Controversy has swirled around the BJP's prime ministerial candidate since 2002, when sectarian rioting in his state killed more than 1,000 people. Modi was accused of not doing enough to stop the violence. But for many voters, that controversy appears to have faded. Instead, Modi has cast himself as an able administrator and decisive leader who has energized the economy of his Gujarat state and holds the promise of doing the same for the rest of the country. Mishra believes BJP's social media campaign played a big role in changing perceptions.
Some of the misconceptions, facts, distortions related to Gujarat or to BJP in general or to Mr. Modi in particular, well, all which has come to be accepted as truth. So what social media did was, people, young people who started putting out these facts over a period of time, writing blogs and so on and so forth, and many, many more people started becoming aware that the truth about Gujarat and Mr. Modi is different. It has started changing the narrative in 2002. And then the economic model of Gujarat, that model has been established in social media.
Using the digital space in this way is new in a country where rallies, media interviews and advertising have been the primary campaign tools for political leaders. But with nearly half of India's internet users active on Twitter and Facebook, social media is becoming a key way to engage voters. That is particularly so for targeting young voters who make up half of the 814 million strong electorate. Social media's reach is evident, Modi has millions of fans on Facebook and followers on Twitter. Another active social media user, Congress Party Minister Shashi Tharoor, also has a massive Twitter following. And the buzz about political parties and their leaders has been growing on digital platforms as top leaders use Facebook interviews and Google Plus Hangouts to connect with voters. Political analysts say the BJP and a new party called the Aam Aadmi Party are using social media more aggressively than the ruling Congress Party, which is expected to fare badly. The party's two top leaders, Sonia Gandhi and Rahul Gandhi, have completely stayed away from online platforms. Deepa Kumar from civic engagement group Grassroot India believes the digital space in India is still young but has begun to play a role.
They've offered another platform which is much easier and much informal. So we've always had news channels, we've always had newspapers. It's the first time that because of social media we're able to see direct engagement. I could wake up in the morning, I could see Mr. Omar Abdullah tweet something on Kashmir. It's definitely helping more than, I think, opinion creation or anything. It's a very informative tool right now.
Others point out that India is still in the nascent stages of using social media. Sunil Abraham from the Center for Internet and Society says although politicians and parties have jumped on the social media bandwagon, its use is nowhere near as sophisticated as in the United States.
Politicians in India still don't fully get social media. They mostly speak just like they used to speak on broadcast media. They don't listen enough. They expect Indians to follow them in millions, but they don't follow millions of Indians. They're not interested in what the social media user is saying online. They're more interested in getting their message across.
According to a study by the Internet and Mobile Association of India, social media could make an impact in 160 of the 543 parliamentary seats. It says the rest of the constituencies have many rural voters who are illiterate and not online. To reach these voters, political leaders continue to hop in and out of helicopters or hit the road in a cavalcade of cars to address rallies. A young politician from a regional party in Bihar state, Rakesh Jha, is convinced that social media still can't replace door-to-door campaigning. Jha says over the coming days, he will travel through scores of villages to reach out to voters face-to-face in a campaign for his grandfather, a former minister who is running again.
I feel very comfortable that, you know, somebody from your family or somebody who's representing that particular person is coming and meeting you in person. We tell them that, you know, we have come to take your blessings for this election. You know, if they have some grievances since last time or whatever. So we try to, you know, talk them out of that.
Political analysts agree that traditional campaigning is not going to be supplanted anytime soon. But they say as the political discourse on social media becomes more vibrant, it is emerging as a powerful tool for politicians to shape opinion. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
Well, thank you for joining us on tonight's Crossroads Asia. Sitting in for Sarah Williams, I'm Dave DeForest. You can get the latest news 24 hours a day at our website. It's voanews.com. Why not check it out? Stay with us. International Edition is next. Susan Yaki will be the host. And we'll be back with more Crossroads Asia tomorrow at 12 hours Universal Time. This is Dave DeForest. Again, have a good evening.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter, where advocates and opponents debate a critical issue of the week. From Afghanistan to Zimbabwe, from the White House to Capitol Hill, we bring you the story behind the headlines. If you have a comment on one of our programs or ideas for topics, please write to us at Encounter, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. That's Encounter, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or if you have access to the Internet,